אנחנו עבדים? מה אנחנו? איך? איך זה יכול להיות? אחרי 10 שנים.
Will Rwanda's refugee deal with Britain suffer the same fate that befell a similar pact with the Israeli regime that collapsed?
It's possible that the deal will see a similar fate because there is a lot of resistance, but it's really going to depend on how much the British taxpayers and the British public and parliament gets in, you know, gets involved, because that is how the and also the organization, the pressure from around the world to stop the deal. Because even the deal in Israel, which was not as highly publicized as this one, was highly resisted. There were many organizations, human rights organizations around the world, including our own, that were a part of resisting that deal. And so I think it's going to depend on the pressure. For the most part, really, pressure is what's going to make it work. But then also the response by the British public to the deal. Right now, it looks like it may fall apart, but you never know.
The UK-Rwanda refugees deal has several precedents. European powers have been targeting Africa for similar agreements since migration pressures increased in 2015. Many African countries and the African Union have rejected such agreements.
In 2021, the African Union slammed reports of a law passed by the Parliament in Denmark to relocate asylum seekers to countries outside the European Union while their cases are being processed. The African Union termed such a move as xenophobic and completely unacceptable.
Rwanda agreed to take in immigrants denied entry into the United Kingdom, even as Kenya declined London's requests to help it ease the burden of unwanted guests. Kenya, which already hosts over 800,000 refugees, most in camps and others in urban centers across the country, reportedly declined Britain's offer to take in the migrants.
According to reports, before making the partnership deal with Rwanda, the UK had approached other countries in the region, including Kenya, which declined the request on a cost-benefit analysis. A Kenyan political analyst, Mustafa Ali, says Western colonial powers are, in fact, the root cause of the current refugee crisis. Let's take a listen.
Upstream and check what is the problem upstream. And this is what Britain should have done. They should be checking the first world, the so-called first world, the international community. Why is it that these many young people are leaving Africa to want to go to Europe? Obviously, there are challenges in Africa. And of course, it starts with our leadership, our leaders, to try and address some of those challenges. There are challenges that are beyond our leaders that are actually caused by just the unjust international system, international community. And the West, particularly Britain, cannot escape blaming this. Colonialism and the kind of subjugation that some of the European countries put Africa to during colonial times, still a big cause of poverty in Africa.
Now, why did Britain approach Kenya first, and what prompted the authorities in Nairobi to reject the plan?
The fact that they declined, I'm not sure why, but I know one thing. Many countries have refused to accept deportees, people who are deported from Western countries. In fact, in places, especially in the Caribbean, for example, places like Jamaica and Trinidad and many other places, a lot of the deportees have become the biggest criminals, violent criminals in those countries. So many countries have refused to accept basically deportees. And what is happening with the British deal with Rwanda is basically a forced deportation without due process to a place that's not even home. That is what's happening. And so those may be the reasons why Kenyan authorities refuse, but I'm not 100% sure. But I know, based on what's happened in other places, those may be the reasons.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame now says the UK approached him over the sending of refugees to his country, as he had helped refugees during his time as African Union chairperson. He also rejected accusations that his deal with Britain was tantamount to slave trade.
This is why I was saying there are things you can't buy about us. Yes. We are who we are, and we are proud people too. We are not involved in buying and selling of people, Rwanda and the UK, or anybody. No, it's just a problem that people will have different views about it. They look at it differently. They know what happened about it. That's okay. People will have looked at it. But at the end of the day, you've got to do something.
The president of Rwanda has defended the deal, claiming it was not about trading people, but it will offer a chance to asylum seekers to begin a new life. Now, what's your take on this, Mr. Getabuke?
At the end of the day, it's all about the money and PR that Kagame, Paul Kagame is who I'm referring to, is going to make off of the people. The government under Kagame, the Rwandan regime under Kagame, under the RPF, is going to make off of the people. That's what it's about. It's about getting money, getting resources, because it is a poor country. And it's also about public relations, you know, having this image of, you know, we are giving human beings a place to begin a new life when even the people there are actually wanting to leave. Last point, Rwanda has one of the highest refugee population on the African continent. It's not only the most highly densely populated country, but it has one of the largest numbers of people who have left the country and to this day are unwilling to return. So Rwanda can't even give a new life and hope to Rwandans who have fled the regime, but they're claiming that they can provide it to the people that Britain wants to trade with them in this human trafficking deal to resettle them and give them a chance at new life. That is a big, bold-faced lie.
Well, I'd like to thank Mr. Claude Getabuke for his incisive analysis. There you have it. The United Kingdom is basically engaged in a human trafficking deal with Rwanda. Let us know what you think about this controversial deal. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Former US President Donald Trump says he no longer has Trump Organization issued cell phones as New York Attorney General investigates his company. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Tells Court He Lost Phones Linked to Alleged Fraud by His Company. Asked by the New York Attorney General to turn over personal cell phones to aid her investigation of alleged fraud at his company, Donald Trump said he had lost the cell phones. In an affidavit filed as part of an attempt to stop the accrual of fines for non-compliance with subpoenas, a $10,000 daily penalty, which has now reached $150,000, the former president said, "I'm not currently in possession of any Trump Organization-issued cell phones, computers, or similar devices. I believe the last phone or device I was issued by the Trump Organization was a cell phone in 2015. I no longer have the cell phone in my possession, and I'm not aware of its current location." Since 1st of January 2010, I previously owned two flip phones and a Samsung mobile phone. I do not have the two flip phones in my possession, and I do not know their current whereabouts. Donald Trump said he took the Samsung cell phone with him to the White House when he was sworn in as president in 2017, but it was taken from me at some point while I was president. I do not have the Samsung cell phone in my possession, and I do not know its current whereabouts. Trump also said he now owns two personal mobile phones, an iPhone, which I have owned for several years and is for my personal use, and a new phone, which I was recently given by Truth Social just last week. Truth Social is Donald Trump's own social media platform, set up to counter what he claims to be censorship by Twitter and Facebook, which banned him after his supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol building in Washington on 6th of January 2021. Donald Trump has not been a prodigious poster of Truth Social, which has struggled. Nonetheless, in his affidavit, Donald Trump said he used his new phone exclusively for posting on Truth Social and no other purpose. "I have never placed or received a call, sent or received a text message, or used this phone in any other manner." Donald Trump also said he submitted his iPhone to the New York investigation in late March to be searched and imaged, then did so again in early May, in an abundance of caution. He added, "Since at least 1st of January 2010, it has been my customary practice to not communicate via email, text message, or other digital methods of communication. I also do not use a computer for work-related purposes," he said. The civil investigation of Donald Trump's financial affairs in New York is only one form of legal jeopardy faced by the former president. In one high-profile case, a grand jury has been picked in Fulton County, Georgia, where a prosecutor is examining Donald Trump's attempts to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden in the southern state of Georgia. Trump has said investigations of his financial and political affairs are politically motivated witch hunts. Nonetheless, Donald Trump's affidavit and others, filed by his lawyers in the New York case, described extensive searches for devices and documents at the Trump Organization in New York, at Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida, and at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Donald Trump's claim to have lost his cell phones prompted widespread skepticism online. Preet Bharara, a former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, who famously refused to take a call from Donald Trump before Trump fired him, wrote, "Let he who has never lost four cell phones cast the first stone." Meanwhile, in other news, Elon Musk has said he will reverse Twitter's ban on the former U.S. President Donald Trump if the Tesla boss completes the takeover of the social media platform.
departure.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another, Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimates alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born, on the 9th of November, 1877, at 5:14 a.m. The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought three small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and four sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hissam al-Din Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shubah hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly,
Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found in Islamic world a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Neckrat, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship, and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young, make my abbas for them attainable.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. It should not be the case that we are popular in the beginning, but later on become tired. No, you should really remain popular. I do not mean that you should definitely continue these provincial trips until the end of your term. They might stop at some point, and this is all right. Popularity is not confined to provincial trips. Being in contact with the people and hearing from them are also manifestations of popularity. Sometimes one hears from ordinary people points that one does not hear from veteran and experienced experts, and one benefits from their viewpoints more. Being in contact with the people and popular reports have this advantage. Another point which I would like to place great emphasis on is the policies on Article 44 of the Constitution, which were announced a few years ago and which everyone spoke highly of, but they have not been acted on. Different administrations have been reminded of this, and they each said that they intended to act on it. But the policies on Article 44 have not been acted on in the true sense of the word. The economy of the country must be truly in the hands of the people, and the administration should only play its supervisory role without playing an executive role. This is very important.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes you put a load on your own shoulder and decide to carry it from a city to another. And sometimes you put it inside a fast vehicle and you drive it. The second one is correct. The fast and active vehicle is the entrepreneur of the country. We must activate these, but you should supervise their work, formulate policies, and take care not to let a mistake be made. However, you must let them work. Both the entrepreneur, the people, and you, as government officials, will benefit from this. This is one issue. Another issue which is very important and which is a long-term project is the issue of economic growth without oil. Just like the countries which do not have any oil and which have a good rate of economic growth and progress and they are not a small number either. This addictive drug, that is oil, has made us addicted since 100 years ago. It is really a difficult form of addiction.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Wednesday morning, Palestinians woke up to the tragic news of the brutal killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the Jenin refugee camp. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank. Her killing drew angry reactions and condemnations in Palestine and around the world. Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned in the strongest terms Israel's killing of the Palestinian journalist.
The Zionist enemy killed Shireen in cold blood in another example of their brutality against Palestinians. Killing her exposes the violent and criminal nature of the Zionist regime. We condemn this brutal crime and we demand that the Zionist regime and its leaders be brought to justice for their crimes.
Shireen Abu Akleh's extrajudicial killing is further evidence of a trend by Israeli regime forces to systematically attack journalists. During the 11-day war in 2021, Israeli warplanes bombed several buildings in Gaza, housing media companies and news channels.
The Zionist regime attacks journalists in order to silence them and to hide the truth. By targeting Palestinian journalists, the Zionist regime wants to terrorize us and stop us from exposing its war crimes to the world. The Zionist regime doesn't want us to show its ugly face.
Statistics show that Israeli regime forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers shot and killed two Gazan journalists and injured dozens more.
This is not the first time Israeli armed forces has targeted Palestinian journalists. They have targeted a number of them during the Great March of Return in 2018. And this is also another addition to Israeli illegal practices against Palestinian journalists by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, one of the most famous journalists in the Palestinian territories. Israel is trying to kill the truth.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Israeli forces have been increasingly attacking journalists in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With every candle symbolizing the path she lit, activists and journalists gathered in front of the Embassy of Palestine in Tehran, not just to condemn her killing by an Israeli sniper, but to show the world that Shireen Abu Akleh's footsteps will be followed. Al Jazeera's 51-year-old journalist was targeted on assignment while wearing a press jacket that made it easy for her to be identified as a journalist.
The policies of our Zionist enemies has always been clear. They are against anyone who unveils the reality on the ground. The killing of a well-known journalist like Shireen shows that they obviously don't want the world to know the truth about Palestine.
We lost a dear colleague who was killed on assignment. This is a sad day for journalists all over the world. What makes it even more tragic is that she was not even in a war zone. This proves that freedom of speech and human rights means nothing to the Zionist regime.
The Palestinian journalist was also a citizen of the United States, and many are now asking why the U.S. is silent about what they can only describe as blatant murder.
Shirin was a veteran journalist and very well known, too. Obviously, the Israeli regime does not want the world to know about its crimes, and that's why they silenced her.
Well, this shows the cruelty of the Israeli regime. As you can see, if we see such an act in other countries, we may face with a strong reaction by the Western governments and also Western media. But today, inside occupied Palestine, we have seen one of the most cruel scenes that could be possible. An Israeli soldier attacked a journalist and killed him in front of the camera. And this shows that, unfortunately, by the double standards of the Western governments and also Western medias, Israeli governments can continue to kill and assassinate everyone. And this is completely against the freedom of speech and the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Shireen Abu Akleh was covering the Israeli forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday. The veteran television correspondent was a household name across the Arab world for her bold coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The tragic event has sparked outrage in Iran as well as other parts of the world. Those who have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Tehran are calling for impunity for Israel to end. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Following the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, Yemeni journalists have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Sana'a to denounce Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists and media activists.
The Yemeni Journalists Union condemns what has happened to Shirin Abu Akleh and her colleague. They were directly targeted by Israeli forces while wearing a press vest to ensure protection in the areas of conflict based on international conventions. Her killing is a flagrant violation of international law. We call on all media activists around the world to express solidarity with Abu Akleh and other colleagues in Palestine.
The Yemeni media activists denounced in the strongest terms the targeted killing of Abu Akleh by Israeli forces as she was covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank.
The news of the martyrdom of Shirin was shocking. And the whole world is shocked because she was a powerful and influential figure and was able to represent a strong voice. The killing of Shirin is a turning point and the beginning of a new phase, and her blood will have a significant impact, God willing, in pushing the free people to move against the Zionist project.
Abu Akleh was a veteran Palestinian journalist for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera television news network. She was hit by a live bullet while covering an Israeli raid in the city of Jenin while wearing a press vest. Yemeni journalists say Shirin Abu Akleh will always remain a symbol of courage for all the free journalists around the world who stand against oppression, whatever it takes. They say Abu Akleh's killing is a blatant violation of international law on the protection of journalists. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Some say the recent election changes everything. Others say it doesn't. But it has changed a century of unionist political dominance.
This state was founded on the basis of a gerrymandered sectarian headcount, where it was believed there would be a permanent and perpetual unionist majority. Nationalists and Republicans were never intended or expected to get the top political job here.
The election has complicated Northern Ireland's existing problems. Sinn Féin nationalists' victory a step towards a future United Ireland, a blow to the unionists, with the Democratic Unionists' party threatening to boycott the Stormont Assembly over a post-Brexit sea border for trade that they say undermines Northern Ireland's position in the United Kingdom.
Among the things that remain to be changed, this reminder of the decades-old sectarian divide, a wall separating communities as it has done through decades of troubles and peace. We tried to speak to people on the unionist side of it to no avail. But real change seems happening in the center. The Alliance Party has doubled its vote share among those who want to increase awareness. Cross-community efforts like those here may speak of a younger generation's desire to understand each other, regardless of which side they're on. And this is not the only center forging such ties, and they're all moving in the same direction.
So the purpose of this is trying to normalize interactions between both communities, to show young people that the culture and identity of those people based on the other side of the wall is no threat to their own culture and identity. And then a copper fastens their sense of culture, identity and space that makes it harder to feel threatened by others.
But while those threats remain, it is clear that there is a middle ground growing, thanks to these nascent cross-community ties. Saeed Puriza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Many believe the crime of sexually abusing a child is even more heinous than murder. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, says 85 million child sex abuse videos and images were identified by the bloc's authorities last year, a record number.
In the EU, the reports related to the European Union, the member states, have increased with 6,000% the last 10 years. Why is this increasing? Of course, nobody knows for sure.
The Commission says it's not known exactly why these crimes are on the rise, but analysts say the EU has been allowed to expand too quickly, with some nations harbouring criminal gangs.
And now, of course, thanks to or due to open borders, are these criminal networks, they started to flourish and integrate further.
The EU Commission is proposing to establish a new agency designed to prevent child sex abuse and support victims.
At least one in five children falls victim to sexual violence during childhood in Europe. So these numbers are really embarrassing.
Anti-trafficking agencies say 2 million children recently entered the EU having fled the conflict in Ukraine, many of them unaccompanied. Gangs and individuals see an opportunity for exploitation.
The police and child protection services need to work together, plus they need to work together across borders, and there need to be better information sharing platforms.
The European Commission has a message for predators.
We are coming for you.
But critics are asking why more has not been done up to now. Given that it promotes itself as a project designed to protect and improve the lives of citizens, rights groups say this issue seriously undermines the credibility of the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Akleh was shot while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The veteran reporter who worked for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel was shot in the face by Israeli forces despite wearing a blue flak jacket clearly marked with press. Israeli officials claim Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist. But another reporter accompanying Abu Akleh, who was also shot in the back, rejected the Israeli claim as a lie.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death. There were no armed people and we cannot put our lives in danger and say the wrong narrative. The Israeli army is a liar and criminal and despicable.
Al Jazeera also said Abu Akleh was assassinated in cold blood and urged the international community to hold Israeli forces responsible. The Palestinian Authority said Abu Akleh's killing is a heinous crime and part of the occupation's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth and commit crimes silently. In Gaza, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas